This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Dying for a Paycheck, How Modern Management Harms Employee Health and Company Performance, and What We Can Do About It by Jeffrey Pfeffer. Narrated by Pat Grimes. Introduction. You don't have to work in a coal mine, on an oil rig, in a chemical plant, or in construction to face a possibly toxic, health-destroying workplace. In today's work world, white-collar jobs are often as stressful and unhealthy as manual labor or blue-collar work, frequently more so. That's because physical dangers at work have been largely eliminated by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, in the United States, and comparable agencies in other countries. Reprising a lesson from the quality movement that what gets inspected and measured and reported gets affected, countries pay attention to workplace fatalities and incidents, such as falls or chemical spills, where bodily harm can be easily ascertained. The result? The rate of workplace deaths in the United States decreased 65% just between 1970 and 2015, while the rate of workplace injuries fell some 72% over that same time. Meanwhile, stress at work, not subject to OSHA reporting or intervention, and seemingly invisible and accepted as an inevitable part of contemporary workplaces, just keeps getting worse for almost all jobs, resulting in an ever higher physical and psychological toll. For instance, the health website WebMD reported that work was the number one source of stress, and the American Psychological Association's 2015 report Stress in America noted that the top two sources of stress were money and work, with almost one quarter of all adults reporting extreme levels of stress. Another poll of almost 3,000 people reported that nearly half of employees reported missing time at work from work-related stress. 61% said that workplace stress had made them physically sick, and 7% said they had been hospitalized because of workplace stress and its physiological effects. If the aggregate statistics are disturbing, the individual stories are truly horrifying. Talk to the person in a senior finance role working in a rapidly growing medical services provider. Confronting almost impossible work demands that required frequent all-nighters, she began taking stimulants, moved on to the exceedingly available cocaine, and numbed the constant workplace stress and abusive supervision with alcohol. Her ultimately successful detox process from workplace-induced alcohol and drug addiction required enormous amounts of psychological and financial resources, and, of course, leaving her toxic place of employment. Or interview the television news producer who demonstrated organizational loyalty and commitment by being willing to go anywhere in the world at any time on almost no notice to help get the story. That person gained 60 pounds in a short period from not having the time to eat properly, let alone exercise. The unrelenting job demands jeopardized the person's marriage and the relationship with their child as well as their physical and mental health. Or converse with the person receiving workers' compensation while on disability leave after being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder caused by their job at the electric utility Southern California Edison. The PTSD came from excessive work demands, too much work given, too lean staffing levels, and the unrelenting pressure from supervisors to complete the impossible workload. The stories are almost endless, and the costs to people, their employers, and the larger society are enormous. For example, the American Institute of Stress maintains that job stress costs U.S. employers more than $300 billion annually. The ill health from workplace stress adversely affects productivity and drives up voluntary turnover. One poll found that nearly 50% of the respondents reported having changed jobs to escape the stress. As we will see in Chapter 2, on the toll of unhealthy workplace practices, the costs to just the U.S. healthcare system approach $200 billion a year, and may be more. Unfortunately, the problems from what IESE business school professor Nuria Chinchilla once aptly called social pollution seem to be getting worse, not better. Possibly the saddest part of the tale, even as organizations of all kinds regularly permit, if not encourage, management practices that literally sicken and kill their employees, these same employers also suffer because toxic management practices and unhealthy workplaces do not improve organizational profitability or performance. On the contrary, Unhealthy workplaces diminish employee engagement, increase turnover, and reduce job performance, even as they drive up health insurance and healthcare costs. All too many workplaces have management practices that serve neither the interests of employees nor their employers. Truly a lose-lose situation. People's needless harm and suffering occur, even as companies tout their environmental bona fides. Ironically, companies have developed elaborate measures to track their progress on environmental sustainability, with little thought given to the company's effects on human sustainability. Although environmental sustainability obviously is essential, so is human sustainability, creating workplaces where people can thrive and experience physical and mental health, where they can work for years without facing burnout or illness from management practices in the workplace. We should care about people, not just endangered species or photogenic polar bears, as we think about the impact of corporate activity on our environments. And as companies obsess over their carbon footprint, they would do well to consider their effects, their footprints, on the human beings, a carbon-based life form, who work for them. As we will see in the pages that follow, if anything is going to change with respect to workplace well-being and employee physical and mental health, some or a combination of the following things will need to occur. First, current and prospective employees must understand what constitutes health risks in their work environments, and that includes the psychosocial risks that are today more omnipresent and dangerous than the risks of physical injury. Armed with that information, people must then begin to select and deselect their employers, at least partly based on stress-related dimensions of work that profoundly influence their physical and mental health. Second, employers will need to understand and measure what their toxic management practices are costing them, both in direct medical costs and more indirectly in lost productivity and increased turnover. That understanding and quantification of the costs of toxic work environments seems like a necessary first step toward change. Third, governments at all levels will need to first acknowledge and measure, and then do something about the externalities created as employers offload people who were physically and psychologically damaged at work onto various parts of the public health and welfare system. The public costs of privately created workplace stress and unhealthy workplaces have already prompted policy attention and action in the United Kingdom and in many Scandinavian countries. In part, because with government-funded healthcare, it is in the economic interests of public agencies to reduce unnecessary healthcare costs, including preventable costs from workplace stress. And fourth, societies will need social movements, or maybe several social movements, that make human sustainability and people's work environments as important as environmental sustainability and the physical environment have become. Decades ago, companies regularly dumped pollutants into the air, water, and ground. Then people decided that preserving the physical environment and having businesses pay for the external harm they were causing were worthy social goals. Because of the environmental movement, publicity, and political pressure, governments all over the world passed laws and nations developed norms that curtailed many actions that polluted the physical environment. In a similar fashion, societies would benefit from movements that resolutely take the importance and sanctity of human life and people's physical and psychological well-being more seriously, not just at life's very, very beginning or at its very, very end, but throughout people's lives, including their lives at work. Another inconvenient truth. Several distinct but interrelated events caused me to delve into the topic of work organizations and their effects on human health while undertaking the research that resulted in this book. First, many decades of research and teaching by both myself and colleagues around the effect of high-commitment or high-performance work practices on productivity and other dimensions of organizational performance had resulted in little to no positive change. Notwithstanding the publication of numerous books, including some of my own, on this topic, workplaces were, if anything, getting worse, with less employee engagement and satisfaction and diminished trust in institutional leadership. Books, articles, and talks on the connections between people and profits seemingly weren't going to change management decisions or organizational practices. What might? As I participated in meetings at the Hewitt Human Capital Leadership Council, prior to Hewitt's merger with Aon, a group of senior human resource leaders from large corporations, And as I served on the Stanford Committee for Faculty and Staff Human Resources, I couldn't help noticing something. The conversations often focused on healthcare costs. Employers seemed obsessed with and relentlessly focused on reducing these costs. The thought crossed my mind that many of the management practices that produced higher levels of employee loyalty, engagement, and performance, things such as job security and decision-making discretion, might also produce healthier workplaces. If that were the case, perhaps employee health and healthcare costs could become the lever to increase the adoption of high-commitment work arrangements, management practices that had been advocated for so long, but were so infrequently embraced and quickly abandoned in times of economic stringency. If companies and countries were going to bend the cost curve of health, to use an oft-heard phrase, changing work environments just might be one of the best places to focus efforts and attention. Second, as I sat on the various committees just mentioned, I was struck by how everything was just about costs and resources, particularly when it came to people. To take just one example, because of the recession that began in 2007 to 2008, Stanford University laid off between 400 and 500 people, and, earlier in the decade, had instituted a wage freeze in the face of a budget shortfall, notwithstanding the university's enormous endowment. During that time, as I drove through the campus one day, I noticed enormous specimen trees sitting in planter boxes awaiting planting in the ground. About a decade earlier, there had been much publicity about the demise of a 300-year-old large heritage oak near the Stanford Family Mausoleum on campus. This tree had been the object of much care and affection, and had received heroic efforts to save its life. Some years later, a Palo Alto News article remarked on the apparently newsworthy event of the cutting down of an oak tree near the soccer stadium because it could not be saved. But it would be replaced by six new trees. Observing all this, I commented to several people that at Stanford, you are better off being a tree than an employee. At too many workplaces, trees, or maybe landscaping, fare better than people. Language, the terms people use to describe the world, tells a lot. When we talk about people at business, we often use terms such as human resources and human capital. When people describe wages and health benefits, employee or healthcare is often followed by the word costs. Years ago, independent power producer AES's co-founder, Dennis Bakke, told me that he objected to one of my book subtitles that read, Building Profits by Putting People First. Bakke said that putting people first should not be solely or maybe even at all in the interests of profits or costs. Instead, Bakke argued, people, as human beings, as living creatures, deserved to have their welfare and well-being receive some priority in management decision-making, independent of the effect of that prioritization on costs or profits. We need to change the language routinely used in business. Well-being and physical and mental health need to become much more focal in conversations and policies. As Bob Chapman, CEO of the privately owned $2.5 billion manufacturing company Barry Waymiller, likes to say, corporate leaders have a responsibility to steward the lives of the employees who are in their hands. The people who come to work are the husbands and wives and sons and daughters of family members who love them. Leaders should ensure that at the end of the day, their employees return home in good shape, prepared to live fulfilled lives outside of work. Third, in political discourse in the United States and some other countries, there is vigorous, ongoing discussion of pro-life policies. But such debates and the laws, appropriations, and regulations that accompany them seldom consider what happens to people during most of their lives when they are working. If we take seriously the fundamental sanctity and importance of human life and well-being, I concluded that there is a moral, ethical reason to be concerned about human health and well-being in the workplace. And if I was concerned about people's welfare and how that was affected by work environments, I ought to understand the magnitude and dimensions of the issue. I had these ideas already in mind when IESE professor Nuria Chinchilla asked me to participate in a conference she was organizing on the general theme of work and family. Chinchilla had talked to me about social pollution and had commented that the real inconvenient truth was not just the destruction of the physical environment, but also the degradation of the social environment, in part through how employers operated. The conference never occurred, but that paper, which began my exploration of the issue of the workplace and human health, appeared in a refereed journal and laid out some of the first ideas on the topic of human sustainability. From that point on, I have gathered information from interviews and epidemiological data and elicited the collaboration of outstanding operations research colleagues to help estimate the aggregate effects of harmful workplace exposures. This book represents what I have learned from those efforts. I can summarize this learning in a few short sentences. The workplace profoundly affects human health and mortality, and too many workplaces are harmful to people's health. People are literally dying for a paycheck. Most important, the situation is worse than I had imagined, affecting people in numerous occupations, industries, and geographies, and cutting across people of various ages and levels of education. What I learned and the people I encountered in my research have fueled my passion and commitment to bring both the data and the stories to light. I do this in the hope that the information will stimulate the many important but attainable changes required to stop the unnecessary psychological and physical carnage occurring in workplaces all over the world. Simply stated, work environments matter. We know they matter for people's engagement, satisfaction, turnover intentions, and performance. Findings that constitute a vast research literature in the domain of organizational behavior. Work environments matter also for people's physical and mental health and well-being. It follows that concern for life and human sustainability, as well as a focus on costs and productivity, needs to include a focus on the workplace and its effects. Chapter 1. Management Decisions and Human Sustainability. According to the Mayo Clinic, the person you report to at work is more important for your health than your family doctor. Bob Chapman, CEO of Barry Waymiller and author of Everybody Matters. The headlines and the data tell the tale. An Uber software engineer making $170,000 a year, Joseph Thomas, committed suicide in August 2016 by shooting himself. His father and his wife blamed workplace stress. He worked long hours, he felt immense pressure and stress at work, and was scared he'd lose his job. He became someone with very little confidence in himself. He was saying he couldn't do anything right. Mr. Thomas was not an isolated case, with Uber employees attributing panic attacks, substance abuse, depression, and hospitalizations to the stress of the job. Workplace stress and its health consequences affect people everywhere. Between January 2008 and the spring of 2010, at least 46 employees of France Telecom committed suicide, with observers pointing to cost-cutting and reorganizations as the cause. In just the 4 months between January and May 2010, 9 employees at Foxconn, the large electronics manufacturer in China that supplies Apple and HP, among many others, killed themselves, and 2 other workers were injured in suicide attempts. The presumptive cause, according to employees, was the working conditions at Foxconn. Moritz Erhardt, a 21-year-old Merrill Lynch, part of Bank of America, intern, collapsed and died in London after working for 72 hours, 3 days straight. The coroner's report said that Erhardt had died as a result of an epileptic fit that may have been triggered by stress and fatigue. Watami Food Service in Japan was accused of driving a new female employee to suicide just 2 months after joining the company. The woman's monthly overtime work exceeded 140 hours. Severe economic problems in the agricultural industry in India resulted in almost 200,000 farmers committing suicide between 2007 and 2009 because of rising debt and resulting economic and existential despair. The consequences of workplace stress cut across countries, specific jobs, and organizational levels. A Chicago commuter train director, being investigated for an unauthorized vacation payout, stepped in front of a train and killed himself. A Maryland lawyer who discovered he was about to lose his job died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. In 2008, as employment insecurity and stress from the severe recession increased, U.S. workplace suicides reached their highest level ever. Some of the most problematic, stress-causing aspects of work environments include low wages, shift work, and the absence of job control. For example, Low wages produce stress from having to survive with little income, and inadequate income impairs access to healthcare services. Not surprisingly, a number of research studies find that low wages predict obesity, anxiety and depression, low birth weights, and hypertension. Many of these problematic job attributes affect primarily lower-level employees. However, professional and C-suite executives are scarcely immune to the effects of poor working conditions on their health and well-being. For instance, Swisscom CEO Carsten Schlöter, 49, had trouble with being on call 24/7. Pierre Wathier, 53, CFO at Zurich Insurance Group, was in the middle of a horrendous conflict with his CEO. Both men committed suicide in 2013. Some people facing difficult workplace conditions get sick or die. Some people confronting toxic workplaces kill themselves. Some individuals facing intolerable workplace stress kill others. In June 2017, a former employee who had been fired from his job at Fiamma, a business that makes awnings and other accessories for recreational vehicles, arrived at his former employer and systematically tracked down and killed 5 people before he committed suicide. Such instances are all too common. In 1986, a mail carrier murdered 14 co-workers and wounded 6 others, thereby prompting the phrase, going postal. In 2013, 397 people were murdered at work in the United States. The presumably good news, that number was down from the 475 work-related homicides reported in 2012. Between 1992 and 2010, there were almost 14,000 workplace homicide victims. The number of people killed in work-related violence while at the workplace is more than were killed by fires and explosions, getting caught in equipment or machinery, and exposure to harmful substances combined. Of course, killings are the most severe and dramatic form of workplace violence. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration estimates that some 2 million employees per year are victims of workplace violence, with many instances going unreported. Clearly, workplace violence is a serious health risk. People, particularly educated, skilled people, often surprise themselves by their reactions to stressful work environments. A self-described recovering banker in South Africa wrote to me about falling off the corporate hamster wheel and slipping into a severe clinical depression, something that 2 business school degrees and numerous leadership training programs had scarcely prepared him for. The whole experience took him by surprise. I ignorantly and arrogantly thought that depression didn't happen to people who were successful, with a good job, house in the suburbs, station wagon, and so on. I never returned to work after my breakdown, but as part of my recovery process, embarked on a master's degree in applied psychology, developed a stress symptom survey, and wrote a book about my experience. Data from some 2,500 white-collar employees uncovered that all organizations we have surveyed are displaying worrying levels of symptomology that is impacting all key business areas. Similarly, a Salesforce.com employee in San Francisco, someone with a business degree from a very prestigious school, told me that when she joined the organization in a management role, she almost immediately had to go on antidepressants to cope with the work environment. Over the years, she has relied on psychotherapy, a career coach, occasional weekends away, a supportive spouse, and massages, among other things, to help her handle a workplace in which the demands from her various bosses, long working hours, and the threat of being fired at any moment for any performance slip-up or political miscue are omnipresent. Like many successful people working in high technology, she doesn't have that much control over her job and her life. Many months pregnant with her first child, she learned on a Thursday that she needed to miss a social engagement that Saturday so she could be on a flight to Paris to arrive on Sunday for a Monday meeting. This is just one example of an ever-changing schedule and job demands that leave her feeling not in control of her environment. Her coping strategies, all of which are expensive, the total cost of the therapists, the personal trainer, and others undoubtedly exceeds $2,000 a month, are possible only because she and her spouse have excellent educations and good jobs. How do the majority of workers, whose salaries don't top the charts, cope with similar workplace stress. Her experience is scarcely unique, even within Salesforce, a company currently on Fortune's Best Places to Work list. A colleague of hers who had recently delivered a child and was ostensibly on maternity leave felt pressure to return to work less than 2 weeks after giving birth so she could present a keynote speech at a major Salesforce event. Naturally enough, the request to come back into work was posed as a compliment. "You have this big role at this important high-visibility meeting, so you should be flattered to be invited and certainly not miss the opportunity to shine in front of the Salesforce brass and the many attendees." The not-so-implicit message? What's wrong with you that your job doesn't come before even your newborn? Both individuals have contemplated leaving their jobs. That fact demonstrates that difficult bosses and stressful work environments harm not only people's health. Toxic workplaces are also an important cause of turnover, job dissatisfaction, and other forms of productivity loss for organizations. Systematic data buttressed the scores of case examples I uncovered in my research. There is the so-called Black Monday syndrome, the fact that more people have heart attacks on Monday morning than at other times during the week, maybe because they are back at work after the weekend. The prevalence of heart attacks on Monday morning has caused hospitals to staff emergency rooms to correspond to the increased risk. The aptly named American Institute of Stress has collated numerous studies of stress. Some highlights from these data. Job stress is far and away the major source of stress for American adults, and it has escalated progressively over the past few decades. 80% of workers in the Attitudes in the American Workplace survey reported feeling stress on the job. Two separate studies reported that about 10% of employees said there was physical violence or an assault in the workplace because of job stress. One report by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health included data showing that one quarter of employees view their jobs as the major stressor in their lives, and that problems at work are more strongly associated with health complaints than any other stressor, including financial or family problems. Work environments are, for the most part, the same in other countries, also frequently too stress-inducing. An annual national survey measuring stress in Australia found that in 2014, 45% of Australians reported being stressed out about work, that in 2013, stress was having at least some impact on the physical health of about three-quarters of Australians, and that workplace stress was at a two-year high. A 2012 Statistics Canada survey showed that 28.4% of Canadians found most work days to be either quite a bit or extremely stressful. And a report in the United Kingdom concluded, "The evidence is overwhelming that work-related mental ill health is a major problem in our society with substantial economic, commercial, and human costs." The gig economy and workplace stress. The evidence suggests that the adverse effects of work environments on people's health may be getting worse. One reason is the changing nature of work, and specifically the rising prevalence of precarious employment, the contract and freelance work of the so-called gig economy. Some forecasts predict that by 2020, 40% of the U.S. workforce will be so-called contingent workers. In 2015, the Freelancers Union noted that one-third of working Americans had engaged in some freelance work during the past year. People working on short-term contracts confront more economic uncertainty and insecurity, and they seldom receive paid time off or other benefits, including training. While many people who perform gigs are doing it to supplement their income, data suggests that sharing economy workers don't make very much money. A chart in Fortune reported that the average monthly income was $229 for people working for DoorDash, $364 for Uber drivers, $377 for Lyft, and $380 for TaskRabbit. People working for Fiverr made, on average, just $103 a month and $98 for GetAround. A New Yorker article quoted platform economy companies' own websites and blogs to make the point of how stressful and difficult such working arrangements are. One Lyft driver in Chicago was praised for picking up a passenger while 9 months pregnant, and finishing the trip as she went into labor. Lyft drivers net about $11 per trip. So, maybe Mary kept accepting riders because the gig economy has further normalized the circumstances in which earning an extra $11 can feel more important than seeking out the urgent medical care that these quasi-employers do not sponsor. Fiverr, which touts itself as the freelance marketplace for the lean entrepreneur, apparently had an ad campaign on New York City subway cars that advocated eating coffee for lunch and noting that sleep deprivation is your drug of choice if you are a doer. A Fiverr video recommended answering a call from a client while having sex. Beyond the horrific stories, there is ample systematic evidence showing the adverse effects of insecure, often contingent employment on people's health and well-being. For instance, one review of 93 studies of precarious employment in industrialized countries found precarious employment was associated with a deterioration in occupational health and safety in terms of injury rates, disease risk, hazard exposures, or worker and manager knowledge of OHS, occupational health and safety, regulatory responsibilities. Management and government neglect of workplace stress and its costs. Notwithstanding the prevalence of workplace stress and its documented ill effects on physical and mental health, strangely, and unfortunately, the workplace and its effects on social sustainability and health remain mostly under the radar. Workplace stress is largely ignored by employers, governments, and yes, business schools too. Notwithstanding an enormous epidemiological literature on the effects of workplace conditions on physical and mental health, with an enormous toll in both healthcare costs and population mortality that I describe in Chapter 2. Chris Till, the former chief executive of the Human Resources Institute of New Zealand, told me that when he talked to the New Zealand government about the connection between workplace conditions and population health, the response was, "Stress is just a normal part of work," with the implication being that nothing could or would be done. Till noted that the government has not yet figured out that workplace injury consisted of more than dramatic physical injuries or accidents, that chronic stress and exposure to management practices that adversely affect health causes both physical and mental health problems and imposes costs borne by business and society. Dame Carol Black, a principal at the Newnham College at Cambridge University, told me that in 2011, she and Professor Sir Gary Cooper, a noted organizational psychologist, conducted a quick survey of more than 100 UK business schools to assess whether they included teaching on health, employee engagement, and well-being in any of their courses. They found that the answer to this question was a resounding no. Nor is the situation much different inside employers, with a very small fraction of organizations measuring workplace-related stress and an even tinier proportion trying to address the problem. Christy Johnson, a Stanford MBA graduate who was the founder and CEO of strategy consulting firm Artemis Connection, has been interested in the people aspect of strategy implementation. She commented to me on the striking resistance to getting people to be honest about what's going on with their workforce. When I pushed back on that comment and asked her about the activities of HR departments and the employee surveys that most places conducted, her response was that these activities were mostly about compliance with rules and legal regulations and risk management, not getting sued, and that many places did not do much with the survey data they collected. One notable exception to the neglect of systematically measuring workplace-induced health and well-being is the Gallup Healthways National Surveys of Well-Being, data that, along with Gallup's research expertise, has brought attention to well-being, employee health, engagement, and company performance. But note that Gallup's results are reported by geographic area, not by specific company. So there is no spotlight on specific workplaces that are doing particularly well or poorly. Moreover, Gallup reported that only 12% of employees strongly agree that they have substantially higher overall well-being because of their employer. It doesn't have to be this way. Of course, there are exceptions, albeit not enough of them. Some companies demonstrate that it is both possible and profitable to care for people's physical and mental health and overall well-being. In 2004, Mark Bertolini, currently the CEO of health insurance company Aetna, suffered a severe skiing accident that almost killed him and left his left arm in constant agonizing pain. That, plus a son dealing with a rare cancer, caused him to get more interested in health as well as in alternative therapies. Aetna has made employee health a priority, with a focus on physical, mental, social, and financial health. In 2015, Aetna increased its internal minimum wage to $16 per hour, which was a 33% increase for the company's lowest-paid employees. About 5,700 people saw their wages increase. The company also changed its health benefits to reduce employees' out-of-pocket expenses. The company offers free yoga and meditation classes that about one-quarter of the workforce has participated in. People who have taken at least one class report, on average, a 28% reduction in their stress levels, a 20% improvement in sleep quality, and a 19% reduction in pain. They also become more effective on the job. The company also offers a weight loss program and health screenings for its employees. In 2016, Aetna launched a student loan repayment program under which it will make matching loan payment contributions up to $2,000 per year. At Aetna, healthcare costs have either gone down or, some years, gone up less than the national average, possibly because of the company's focus on employee well-being. Bob Chapman is the CEO of Barry Waymiller, a $2.5 billion manufacturing company with about 12,000 people working in plants all over the world. One day a number of years ago, Chapman had an insight that he explained to me. We became aware that all 12,000 people who work for us are somebody's precious child, and we know that the way we treat them will have a material impact on their life. Chapman decided that the goal of the company should be to send people home fulfilled at the end of the workday. When the company began seeing employees not as objects, but as people who are precious to others, they built a culture in which people cared for one another. One consequence? A much higher level of altruism, where people genuinely offered to do things for others without expecting anything in return. The company has been quite financially successful, with a compound growth rate in earnings of about 16% per year, even though it operates in very difficult manufacturing industry segments. Chapman is now an evangelist for this way of thinking, having written a book, Everybody Matters, and going around giving talks about the Barry Waymiller approach and its journey to building a culture focused on employee well-being. He commented, 88% of all people in this country feel they work for an organization that does not care about them. 3 out of 4 people are disengaged. We know for a fact that when people do not feel valued, when they do not feel like they work in a good environment, there are consequences. I think there's something like a 40% reduction in health-related issues when people feel happy in their work compared to feeling stressed. In this audiobook, we will meet some of the companies that do care about their people's well-being, and we will also review numerous research studies and books that speak to the economic and social rationales for taking care of employees. It is possible to do well and to do good at the same time. But the data on work stress, employee health, and employee engagement suggest that many more company leaders need to get and heed the message. Where are the people in the sustainability movement? Sometimes, even the most mundane actions and decisions reveal a lot about existing social values and priorities. So while economic development and land use decisions have many, some argue too many and too onerous, requirements for preserving the physical environment, such regulatory oversight invariably mostly ignores the well-being of the employees who may be affected. A simple example. When in 2010, Safeway, the large grocery store chain, sought to expand its store in Burlingame, California, near where I live, the company filed an environmental impact report open to the public's inspection. EIRs are, of course, required for any significant building or redevelopment projects. The report detailed the effects of the store expansion and construction on traffic patterns and congestion, outlined the landscaping and signage plans to preserve as much aesthetics as possible, and highlighted the many things that the company and its contractors would do, such as recycling waste from the demolition of the old structure to minimize the environmental impact of the project. There was, of course, nothing unusual about this report, one of hundreds of thousands filed each year. The fundamental premise behind such environmental reviews is simple. Building anything invariably disturbs aspects of the physical environment, and good stewardship requires that companies take care to minimize the physical disruption and conserve and preserve as much as possible of the natural environment while still permitting economic progress and development to occur. Should such building or remodeling entail the significant modification or destruction of structures deemed to be of historical significance, the burdens placed on the project are correspondingly higher and the requirements for preservation all the greater. In addition, filing such reports and going through environmental reviews prior to construction recognizes the fact that it is easier to prevent harm than it is to subsequently remedy possible adverse impacts to the physical environment or historically significant buildings or gardens once damage has occurred. It has become taken for granted that in the case of the physical environment, we are concerned about sustainability and environmental degradation. Laws and regulations preclude and punish activities that foul the air or dirty the water. Many companies trumpet their green credentials in their advertising, annual reports, and other messaging. They detail their actions to offset carbon emissions and mitigate other forms of environmental danger. These practices have become such a part of everyday business conduct that people often forget there was a time not that long ago when environmental regulations were vigorously opposed and many fewer businesses had made environmental sustainability an important part of their branding, targeted at both their customers and employees. At first glance, nothing seems missing from the Safeway EIR, which is, because of the limited scope of the project, just replacing some existing buildings in an already developed commercial area, quite boring to read. But something is missing from consideration of the store's remodeling impact. The store would be closed slightly more than a year during its reconstruction. The existing store had scores of employees. This store closing occurred in 2010, during a time of economic stringency as the U.S. job market slowly recovered from a severe recession. So while Safeway would remove trees and temporarily disrupt traffic and parking during construction, all factors addressed in its EIR, the company's actions would also affect the economic well-being and lives of its employees, something not discussed anywhere in its environmental impact statement. Although, as it turned out, Safeway did offer transfers to nearby stores to at least some of its employees, there is no mention of this in the EIR, no mention of what would happen to the other employees, no mention, in short, of the human impact of this relatively routine act of economic development. Nor is this case unusual. The European Union risked a trade war with the United States by seeking to force airlines, including those from countries outside the European Union, to pay for the carbon pollution created by flights into and within Europe. Meanwhile, the European Union apparently was unconcerned about whether or not those same airlines, such as United, Delta, and American, had already reduced and continued to cut wages, jobs, and pensions, thereby negatively affecting the human environment and the psychological and physical well-being of their employees. Want more evidence of this neglect of people in the sustainability reporting movement? If you go to the website where automobile manufacturer General Motors presents its sustainability bona fides, you can learn that GM is number one in clean energy patents, is among the top five in the world in the number of solar arrays hosted, has 11 landfill-free sites, and operates in 26 sites certified by the Wildlife Habitat Council. What you won't learn is the number of jobs the company has cut over the past decade, what GM has done to reduce wages and benefits for new and experienced employees, and how the company manages its office and plant work environments in ways that affect people's well-being. Nor does General Motors, in its sustainability reporting, present data on the aggregate physical and mental health of its current or former employees. Similarly, Walmart, the largest employer in the United States, with more than 1 million employees, has three environmental sustainability goals that cover energy, waste, and products. The company's global responsibility reporting emphasizes renewable energy and emergency preparedness, among other things. When the report speaks to measures pertaining to people, the focus is on the number of associates promoted, the proportion of new hires that were women and people of color, and the company's record of hiring veterans. No mention of providing wages that people can live on, health insurance so they can access health care, or work-family policies such as scheduling regular hours so associates can meet their non-work obligations. For all the laudable advances made in reporting about and to various stakeholders, we have not begun to scratch the surface when it comes to reporting on and promoting human sustainability. It remains the case that the study and reporting of human rights and labor issues linked to sustainability risks are far less advanced than environmental and governmental ones. These examples are not to single out Safeway, GM, Walmart, or any other specific company for its reporting, or lack thereof, about the human consequences of its management practices. Reporting on initiatives to reduce waste, conserve energy, recycle, and generally protect the physical environment is rapidly becoming the norm among a growing number of particularly larger companies that are increasingly embracing ever more comprehensive sustainability reporting. Reporting on employee well-being, when it occurs at all, is frequently limited to data on time loss from accidents and other very limited indicators that fail to adequately assess social sustainability. Of course, there are exceptions, and some companies have adopted and report on a more comprehensive perspective on employee well-being. Other companies could learn from these cases. For example, in 2012, BT, British Telecom, revised their health and safety policy to include employee health and well-being as key components of the company's people strategy. The company reports on lost time because of illness as well as accidents. Promoting good health is the first item listed in BT's health and well-being strategy. The company provides support for people who become ill or disabled to be able to transition to different jobs so that they do not have to leave the workforce. BT has developed a mental health toolkit and a stress risk assessment and management tool, and trained almost 5,000 people managers in mental health support since 2008. Most important, BT's management system and philosophy begins with the first and foremost principle for any organization should be to avoid doing harm to its people. If more companies took employee health this seriously in both goals and training, companies and people would benefit. The simple fact that as a society we are apparently profoundly concerned about the physical environment and largely indifferent to what companies do to the social environment, to the human beings who work for them, has important implications for understanding the contemporary world. It helps explain why jobs, particularly good jobs, are disappearing and why many employees in numerous countries report increasing levels of stress and psychological and physical distress. The world of work provides a daily manifestation of the simple truism, out of sight, out of mind, or its corollary from the quality movement, what gets inspected gets affected, and what does not get measured doesn't change or even degrades. With no measurement, no reporting, no requirements for considering the consequences of social pollution, as distinguished from environmental pollution, work organizations continue to use decision logics that leave them blissfully, perhaps even willfully, unaware of what they are doing to their employees. People are missing in public policy, too. The emphasis on the physical over the social environment holds not just for companies and their reporting, but for public policy as well. At both local and national levels, environmental regulations, for instance, limit waste discharges and carbon dioxide emissions and mandate automobile mileage standards. There are best practices, policies, and regulations for corporate governance, such as requiring outside directors on certain board of director committees, and efforts to measure, disclose, and limit environmental and governance risks. These activities are much more extensive than are comparable efforts focused on employee well-being. Monitoring the most basic aspects of physical safety, such as workplace accidents and deaths, has, over time, driven down workplace fatalities and injuries substantially, and some aspects of chemical exposure have been regulated. But otherwise, employers in the United States and elsewhere are mostly free to impose layoffs, require flexible hours and shift work, and inflict other hardships that have important consequences for human health without considering the effects of these decisions. It is true that there has been some, albeit limited, policy focus on the effects of workplace conditions on employee health and well-being, and such an emphasis is growing. The World Health Organization, recognizing that health is a human right and that population health confers many benefits, has acknowledged the psychosocial causes of ill health, including such causes located in the workplace. In the United States, for decades, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, has recognized that the work environment can be a threat or risk factor for people's physical and mental health. The agency has sought not only to assess the magnitude of health risks at work, but also to have employers remediate unhealthy conditions in workplaces to reduce the enormous human toll. However, it was only in June 2011 that NIOSH launched the Total Worker Health Program as a strategy of integrating occupational safety and health protection with health promotion to prevent worker injury and illness. And around the same time, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced Healthy People 2020 with the goal of increasing access to programs to reduce employee stress. But for the most part, the emphasis remains on preventing occupational injuries and exposure to hazardous physical conditions, coupled with encouraging health promotion programs, with comparatively limited attention focused on changing the psychosocial dimensions of work that have profound effects on health. There has been somewhat more policy attention to the connection between work and health in the United Kingdom, possibly because of more and better measurement, and partly because health costs created by harmful workplace practices affect governmental budgets because of how healthcare is delivered and paid for. The United Kingdom has focused somewhat more public policy attention on this issue. Dame Carol Black, a principal at Cambridge University, noted in a personal communication to me that the British government, of whatever political persuasion, has been increasingly interested in this agenda since 2005, when they produced the report, The Health, Work, and Well-Being Strategy, The Vision. We still have a long way to go, but the effect of poor work, poor workplaces, poor leadership, and inadequate, poorly trained managers is now gaining traction. Policy attention and reporting permits public entities to estimate the cost of harmful work environments, and that measurement, in turn, spurs action. So, in the United Kingdom, between 2007 and 2008, an estimated 13.5 million working days were lost to stress-related absence. And an estimated 1.1 million people who worked in 2011 to 2012 were suffering from a work-related illness. Because of the enormous economic costs of workplace-induced stress, the UK Health and Safety Executive Agency has promulgated management standards to try to reduce the incidence, and therefore the costs, of work-related health problems. Nevertheless, the UK guidelines and the NIOSH initiatives rely more on voluntary implementation by companies than do comparable policies instituted by other agencies that are focused on the physical environment and that have more substantial fines and regulatory enforcement resources behind them. The implication? If we truly care about human beings and their lives, including how long people live, if we are concerned with social sustainability and not solely environmental sustainability, we need to first understand and then alter those workplace conditions that sicken and kill people. Health as a measure of well-being and social system effectiveness. We should care about mortality and human well-being for several reasons. In the first place, international human rights laws and conventions, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, consider workplace health and safety issues to be fundamental human rights. The moral and social justice foundations for considering human health abound. Second, health status is one important indicator of organizational or any other social system's performance. As British epidemiologist and expert on health policy Sir Michael Marmot wrote, health functions as a kind of social accountant, If health suffers, it tells us that human needs are not being met. He quoted Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen. The success of an economy and of a society cannot be separated from the lives that members of the society are able to lead. Health status and well-being, self-reported physical and mental health, and other indicators such as infant mortality and people's life expectancy are all good barometers of how well any social system, be it a country, city, or work organization, is functioning. In well-functioning systems, people are well and live long. When systems break down or suffer dysfunction, people get sick and die. This general principle is nicely illustrated by analyses of the missing men of Russia and Eastern Europe. The dissolution of the Soviet Union and the freeing of the Soviet-dominated or occupied countries of Eastern Europe would eventually lead to economic growth and improving health. But in the transition, access to formerly state-provided health services declined, unemployment and economic inequality and insecurity all increased, and social problems, including alcohol abuse, soared. During this turbulent time, there were dramatic declines in life expectancy in much of Eastern Europe and a decrease in average male longevity of 7 years in Russia following 1989. Put another way, in the decade following the collapse of communism, there were an estimated 4 million excess deaths, over and above what would have been expected from the historical trend. Declining health and increased mortality mirrored and reflected the economic insecurity and breakdown of social support systems as Eastern European countries transitioned to new governments and social arrangements. Another oft-used indicator of social system functioning is life satisfaction or subjective well-being. And economists, as well as other social scientists, are increasingly interested in understanding the determinants of happiness, as well as how to best measure the construct. Not surprisingly, happiness and health status are positively related. A study of 151 early adolescents reported a positive correlation between health and happiness, with a similar positive relationship between health and happiness observed in a sample of 383 older adults. A study of the relationship between happiness and health in 46 countries found a strong relationship between the two. And the World Database of Happiness summarized numerous studies from multiple countries evidencing strong correlations between health status and happiness. These results make sense because it is harder to be happy if a person is ill. The relationship between health status and measures of subjective well-being further make the case that the health of an organization's employees is a useful and important measure of one dimension of organizational effectiveness. In addition to the moral importance of human life and the role of health as an indicator of system functioning, there is also a strong economic rationale for a greater focus on the effect of the workplace on employee well-being. It should not be news that healthcare costs are soaring all over the world, in part because of aging populations. Birth rates have declined, which means that average population ages have increased, but also because of ever-eroding employment circumstances. One study linking working conditions to mental health noted that available evidence provides support for the idea that job quality in most European countries has progressively deteriorated. And what is true for Europe holds also in the United States with its more laissez-faire approach to labor market protections. Much, if not most, of the increase in healthcare costs faced by countries around the world arises from chronic and somewhat preventable diseases such as cardiovascular disease and diabetes. A World Economic Forum, WEF, report noted that in the United States, 75% of the more than $2 trillion annual healthcare spending was accounted for by people with chronic diseases. And these chronic conditions, such as diabetes and circulatory problems, are spreading throughout the developing world, including to countries such as China, Russia, India, and Brazil. Ill health exacts a huge toll on productivity at both the societal and individual company levels of analysis. That same WEF report stated that the productivity losses from employees with chronic disease were as much as 4 times the already large direct costs of treating those diseases. Healthy personal behaviors come from healthy workplaces. Because of ever-increasing healthcare costs, the productivity loss arising from sickness, and the costs coming from having to replace